Hello and welcome back to another edition of the Dog and Duck Show. My name is Warren Maynard. I'm the dog. With me is my co-host, Mark Schmoor. He is the duck. I was out of town last week. Big thanks to my friend, JJ Vansel, for filling in and representing the dogs on the Dog and Duck Show extremely well. I enjoyed listening to the podcast while sitting next to the pool in Orlando, soaking up some vitamin D and working on my suntan. And both the University of Washington and the University of Oregon are sitting pretty in the sun right now, 2-0, facing a lot of positive feedback right now. So, Mark, let's get into it. Your Ducks escaped narrowly over the weekend, so I've got to assume you are doing pretty well right now.
Warren, I cannot tell you the relief that I felt on Saturday night, and that feeling of relief has continued throughout the last couple of days. I just think back and I go, survive in advance. And it wasn't always pretty, but anytime you win on the road against a decent team, it's something to celebrate. So I'm taking it and I'm celebrating.
Well, those of us who listen to the Dog and Duck Show will remember that a few weeks ago we did a preseason preview where we walked through every game and made our predictions. And Mark, I originally marked that game as a W for Oregon, but as you outlined all the reasons why it could be a potential trap game, a potential loss for the Ducks, I changed my prediction mid-show and called for Texas Tech to defeat Oregon. And I was almost right. And we'll break that down a little bit. What happened? Bo Nix versus former Duck quarterback Tyler Shuck. And lots of interesting storylines to break down there. But the story, I think, in many ways for this season has been the tremendous start of the college football season by the Pac-12 in their final year of existence. Eight teams finished in the top 25 this week after wins by USC, Washington, Oregon, Utah, Colorado, Oregon State, Washington State, and UCLA. So in my opinion, it's the deepest and most talented Pac-12 roster from top to bottom that we have seen in a long, long time, if in my entire lifetime. And, you know, there were some teams like Oregon and Utah that things looked pretty precarious going into the fourth quarter, but they found a way to pull it out. Let's give a hand to our dear friends in Pullman, the Washington State Cougars, that they jumped out to an early halftime lead, and then Wisconsin came back, scored a couple touchdowns, and it looked like, oh, here we go. This is going to be a classic Coug moment, but head coach Jake Dickert settled the boys. They came out with the W, and at the end of the game, he made an impassioned plea to anybody who's listening: we belong in the Power Five. So, Mark, in general, what were some of your takeaways from this weekend in the Pac-12?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. There was quite a bit of hype kind of coming in to the conference season. We certainly were hyping it up. And I had in the back of my mind kind of a thought at one point of, I was thinking, like, what if the conference just doesn't live up to this hype, you know, this year? What if Utah drops their opener to Florida and Oregon drops it to Texas Tech, or Washington loses to Michigan State? And what if we're kind of sitting there at the end of September going like, oh, maybe, you know, the Beavers don't look nearly as good as they did last year. Like, I had kind of this scenario in the back of my mind of like, what if none of these teams really look quite as good as we think they are? And Yeah, Warren, the truth is it's the opposite. It's like,
it's exceeded, right? Yeah.
Like, we didn't have Colorado on our radar. We didn't really have Washington State on our radar. You know, UCLA turning to a true freshman quarterback seemingly has given them a breath of fresh air. Like, and so to have eight teams in the top 25 in what is basically the last year of the conference as we know it is an absurd thing. And if you fast forward, I mean, the Huskies have like a legitimate game this week. They're pretty much the only one of those contenders that's playing anybody relevant, you know? So if you fast forward to the first week of conference play, all of a sudden it's Colorado at Oregon, Oregon State at Washington State, UCLA at Utah. Those are three games that are all conference openers that all feel like huge ramifications for both teams involved. So I'm wanting to click fast forward now that Oregon has gotten through their, you know, big non-conference game. I'm just wanting to get to that, but we have another week. And obviously the Huskies have a huge game to get through before we get into conference play.
Absolutely. And, you know, we talked about in the preseason how incredibly loaded this Pac-12 conference was when it came to quarterbacks. And of course we mentioned Bo Nix and Michael Penix Jr. and defending Heisman Trophy winner Caleb Williams and the grizzled veteran Cam Rising. And then, you know, there were some guys like Jaden Delora that put up a ton of yards last year. But Mark, looking at the passing yardage leaders in the nation right now, three of the top five are coming from the Pac-12. Number one, Shedeur Sanders. Number two, Michael Penix Jr. And number five, Cam Ward. So, you know, it's just like you said, from top to bottom, there is talent, there is productivity, and someone is going to have to win. Someone's going to have to lose in each of these conference games that are coming up. So things will sort themselves up over time, but whatever Pac-12 team you're cheering for right now, aside from perhaps Arizona State and Arizona and Cal, you're feeling pretty good right now about the way the season is looking.
And Stanford.
Yeah. So four squads that are clearly at the bottom tier, but even Cal played a respectable game against Auburn.
All three of those teams battled it out.
Yeah. So
all three of those teams had at least a half where they outplayed their opponent in their biggest games of the year thus far. So there's at least some signs of hope with each of those three, where Stanford just seems kind of pretty much hopeless. But for the other eight, I think expectations are sky high for each of them. And, you know, you mentioned all of those guys with the passing stats. These are not empty stats. Like, Michael Penix played Boise State, who was a top 15 defense last year. Cam Ward played Wisconsin, who's historically always had good defenses. Shedeur Sanders has got to be one of the few quarterbacks in the entire country that has played two Power Five opponents in his first two games. So the fact that he's, you know, leading the nation in passing yardage, having played, you know, one of the tougher schedules of anybody out there. It's real. Like, there are a lot of really good teams. I think they could all beat each other on the right day. Mm-hmm. Maybe one or two kind of rise above the crop in the coming weeks. I just think it's going to be so much fun, Warren. It's going to be so much fun to watch this play out.
Absolutely. And Mark, before we dive into Oregon's thrilling road win against Texas Tech, I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit, and I want you to tell us a little bit about some of the writing projects that you're working on this season. Mark's Moments, that's kind of been your website, your pet project for getting all of your sports thoughts and stories and, you know, memories out there. But, you know, you've kind of opened that up. You've kind of taken on some additional challenges this year. So walk us through some of the things you're doing from a writing perspective and how any of our listeners can, you know, follow the work that you're putting out?
Yeah, so the blog that I write for is mschmore.substack.com is the address for that, and the blog is titled Mark's Moments. And essentially, I'm trying this college football season to do three pieces a week, all kind of related to this last wonderful year of the Pac-12/Pac-10 conference. And so how that works is Monday I've been publishing like a weekend recap where I just kind of run through each of the games and try to pull out maybe a little nugget of interest about each game from the previous weekend involving schools in the conference. On Wednesdays, I've started a top 10 series, like a historical top 10 series. So the first week I did the top 10 quarterbacks in Pac-12, Pac-10 play. So going back to 1978, which is when the Arizona schools were added and the Pac-8 became the Pac-10. That was kind of the time frame that I used. I put together a top 10 list. This series of top 10s is also being run on superwestsports.com. Mm-hmm. So they've been gracious enough to post those articles there as well. So they ran that one over the weekend. And then on Fridays, once we get into conference play, I'm hoping to do a little something about Oregon and their kind of historical rivalry with each of their conference opponents. A lot of these rivalries are going to go away. So, for instance, when Oregon plays Stanford, I want to take a look back at the history of the Oregon-Stanford rivalry and call out some of the greatest moments for me as an Oregon fan and some of the worst moments for me as an Oregon fan. The hope there is that if I have any Stanford fans in my sphere, that they would enjoy reading that just as much mm-hmm. as an Oregon fan would, because it's highlighting both the good and the bad of the rivalry from both perspectives. So that is the goal going forward throughout the college football season, is to publish something every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday morning. And thus far I've been holding to that schedule. I'm right now, Warren, working on the top 10 offensive linemen from the conference history. That one's going to go live tomorrow morning. So, yeah, would love for readers to check out mschmore.substack.com to check out some of those articles.
Well, it's great stuff. You're a terrific writer and a great historian and lover of the sport and the conference. And I am enjoying reading as many articles as I can get my hands on each week. So keep it up. And I certainly hope that Lincoln Kennedy is going to find his way onto that top 10 list for all-time offensive linemen. But perhaps we'll all have to wait till tomorrow morning to find out what the grand reveal is on that.
I don't want to give away the whole list, but I can tell you that Lincoln Kennedy is included.
All right. Well, then it has become valid.
Yeah.
All right. Well, hey, let's talk about this win by the Ducks. On the road, in the heat, in Texas, against a Texas Tech team that had lost their opening game. I think it would have been very easy to take it for granted that this is an easy W after seeing them stumble coming out of the gate. But the Texas Tech, Red Raiders, they came out with a lot of fire, a lot of firepower, and former Oregon quarterback Tyler Shuck really put this team on his shoulders through the air and on the ground to give the Red Raiders a real fighting chance to upset the Ducks at home.
Yeah, I mean, this is a team, if you remember in our season preview, I pointed out that Bruce Feldman of The Athletic thought Texas Tech was a top 20 team coming into the year, that they had talent at many different positions that jumped off the screen to him. This is a team that plays really well at home. They beat both Texas and Oklahoma at home last year in high-scoring shootouts. So regardless of the opening loss to Wyoming, I was looking at this as Oregon is playing a top 25 caliber opponent on the road in a hostile environment in 100-degree heat and everything that comes with it. And I think it lived up to that. I mean, I think Texas Tech came to play. Both teams had kind of some early season sloppiness. I think Oregon committed 14 penalties, which, you know, Josh Connerly alone, the prized offensive line sophomore, committed 3 offsides penalties, I think all in the first half, because I think he was just kind of so wound up and took him a while to kind of get his own emotions under control. So there were some things like that that had the mark of an early season road game and a team with a lot of young players that maybe haven't been in that environment yet. A lot of new players playing together for the first time and maybe haven't figured out all of those things yet. So, but at the end of the day, Warren, it was also just, it was a thrilling game. It was a thrilling game. It required, you know, a comeback victory from Oregon. It required a lot of composure down the stretch, both on the offensive and defensive sides of the ball, for them to make plays when it mattered. And as an Oregon fan, I think got to feel great about that.
Yeah. And you mentioned composure, and I think certainly the play of Bo Nix at the end of the game was a key component to that. And he's done it now. He's been a college starter for several years, both at Auburn and at the University of Oregon. And that experience and that calm seemed to really show off in the fourth quarter on the road.
Yeah. And he was good the entire game, even when they weren't moving the ball. It wasn't really because he was necessarily making any critical mistakes. He didn't turn the ball over at all. He hit Troy Franklin for a 70 plus yard bomb on the second series of the game. So he was making plays, but his time to shine came midway through the third quarter. Oregon had a rough start to the third quarter. They get stuffed on a 4th-and-1 quarterback sneak. They have a punt blocked. They give up a couple of touchdowns to Texas Tech, and they go from leading by 5 to now they're down by 9. Crowd is hostile. And Nix led a 17-play drive that just kind of took the air out of the building, gets Oregon with the score to pull them within 2. They get the ball back with about 5 minutes to go, and they've got to go down and set up a game-winning field goal. And again, he was cool as a cucumber, made the right reads, drove the offense down into the red zone, killed the clock as much as they could, and then took the field goal. So yeah, it's the third time, Warren, in his brief tenure at Oregon, that he's had a 2-score deficit in the fourth quarter that he's had to overcome, which takes a lot out of a quarterback to know that you've got to execute on multiple drives in a row to give your team a chance to win. That's, you know, that's a real test for a quarterback, and he's passed that test several times now.
The Bodacious campaign continues to grow. So there's no reason to not continue to hope that he'll be in New York at the end of the season. But Mark, you mentioned the 4th-and-1 play that didn't work out in the third quarter. And that seemed to be a pretty critical theme for this game, both for Oregon and for Texas Tech. And we've talked about Dan Lanning and his aggressive approach to going for it on fourth down, where maybe some more experienced coaches might be a little bit more conservative on those types of plays. And it certainly has worked out in his favor on a few notable occasions. And there's also been a few games where it, you know, was pretty costly for him. But break down this fourth down theme that came up from both teams and both coaching squads on Saturday.
Yeah, well, I think on the Oregon drive, that was, you know, in the third quarter, they faced a 4th-and-1. It was kind of a long one, I guess you could say, maybe. And they tried a quarterback sneak, which was a play that last year worked to great success for them because of the interior of their line. The senior-laden line really was able to move some bodies. And that was a play they went to over and over again in short yardage situations. And in this particular situation, they went to it earlier in the game and were successful with it. I think that was on a third and short. And then they went to it on a fourth and short and it got stuffed. And I think that is a reflection at this point that that interior of the offensive line isn't quite at the level that Oregon wants it to be at. You know, Oregon has a really high standard of offensive line play, and they struggled to move the ball between the tackles for most of the game. And it really did show up on that that fourth and one. What's interesting is that has been Lanning's MO, is to kind of be aggressive on fourth down. But there were multiple opportunities later in the game where one thought he might have been more aggressive. And he played for field goals instead of touchdowns. There was a fourth and two at the 5 yard line where he took the points. And then on the final drive of the game, he basically had his running backs, you know, try to stay in bounds and go down rather than trying to, you know, call something a little more creative and get into the end zone, content to take the field goal at the end. So, you know, you've kind of said you can't do it. You can't do it both ways. You've either got to kind of go all in on this philosophy or not. And This was a little more of Lanning seeming to kind of choose his moments in regards to that, which I thought was interesting. On the other side, I think Texas Tech was looking at it and saying, this offense seems to be finding itself. They just, you know, took us down the field on a 17-play drive, and we couldn't get them off the field. And if we give them the ball back, we may not see the ball again. And so it's, you know, it's hard to completely dismiss that line of thinking. Yeah, you know, we can kind of pick and choose with some of this stuff in terms of when it works, we praise a coach. When it doesn't work, we criticize a coach. I think in this particular case, one of them worked out, one of them didn't work out. It doesn't mean that one decision was right and the other one was wrong. What I actually think was the more interesting decision-making from the two coaches, Warren, was, I don't know if you caught this, but on Oregon's first touchdown of the game, similar to what they did against Portland State last week, they did kind of one of those wild swinging gate two-point conversions. They converted it to get up to, you know, 8 points right off the bat. And what that forced Texas Tech to do later in the game was they then went for two in an attempt to tie it. They didn't get it.
Right.
And then that turned out to be a huge factor late in the game, because when Oregon kicked a field goal to go up by 1 point in the final 2 minutes of the game, it felt like the difference in the game was that Oregon converted a two-point conversion and Texas Tech didn't. So that was one of those decisions that Lanning said in the post-game press conference, hey, yeah, it's great to sit up here in a press conference and talk to you after we run that play and it works. But at some point we're going to run that play and it's not going to work. And I'm still going to have to sit here and talk about it. So he's aware that it's kind of it, you know,
and that really is the case. I mean, you know, whatever it is, whether we're talking about fourth downs, going for two when you don't have to, ultimately it's high risk, it's high reward. If you get it, you're brilliant. If you don't get it, you're a buffoon, but you can't. And I'm not saying that a coach who goes for it on fourth down has to go for it on every fourth down. He can still pick and choose. But if you are going to be that coach who gets lauded 1 week for making that, you know, more bold or audacious call, then you have to be prepared. And Lanning is acknowledging that. You have to be prepared to take the criticism when it doesn't work out and acknowledge that, hey, that decision may have cost us this game, but we're going to, you know, there's a mindset there that says we're going to put the ball in our hands.
We're going to
trust ourselves.
Absolutely. And this is a thing that, I mean, stealing a point on a 2-point conversion after the opening touchdown was really, that was a hallmark of Chip Kelly's tenure at Oregon, Oregon had a multitude of different formations that they would run for those trick plays. Steve Greatwood, longtime offensive line coach for Oregon, designed all of those plays. Mark Helfrich pointed that out. He was doing color commentary in the Texas Tech game, and he was kind of giving the history of that a little bit. And Oregon was so confident in that that they did it in the national title game against Auburn and stole a point, you know, and had an 8-7 lead in the national title game because they had a trick play in mind for that 2-point conversion. So they used it to such efficiency, and it really did put teams in a tough spot because now you're forcing a team to have to play catch up at some point later in the game. They're going to have to go for two just to pull even. So if you can utilize that and have that in your toolkit, it can be a real game changer as far as strategy in game. It can also be a real game changer in that it wastes a ton of time for the opposing team in practice to now have to run through all of these little gimmicks and know how to defend them all, which I think is part of the reason why a team like Oregon does it is just to waste time for the other team preparing to try to figure out how to stop it. So as an Oregon fan, knowing the history that Oregon has had with these plays, and a unique history, I don't know of any other school that really kind of embodied that the way that Chip Kelly's Oregon teams did. I love it. And I hope Lanning and his special teams coach continue to tinker with those sorts of things to try to give their team an edge, because I think it can really pay dividends down the road.
Well, Lanning came to the University of Oregon as the former defensive coordinator for the national championship winning Georgia Bulldogs. And last year, defense was more of a liability than an asset. What are you seeing right now from this Oregon defense, after watching them compete against it was the Shucks versus the Ducks on Sunday or Saturday, but what are your takeaways about the defense?
Yeah, there were certainly some things that you don't like to see. There were a few different pass interference penalties in the secondary that had me rolling my eyes. There were, a few different big plays given up. They gave up a 58-yard run to Tyler Shuck on the opening series of the game. So a few things like that you hope can be coached out over the course of the season, but are certainly kind of troubling things if they're not coached out, are the types of things that can really hinder a defense from performing at their full potential. Ultimately, they held Texas Tech to 30 points. I don't know whether you consider that like a winning number or not. Last year when they played Texas, they scored 37. When they played Oklahoma, they scored 51. So if you look at it in comparison to those two games, maybe 30 points in Lubbock is a good number. I think the thing that I was most encouraged by, Warren, was the big plays that Oregon made. And I'm talking about four sacks. They forced four turnovers. One of those was the Hail Mary at the end, but three legit game-changing turnovers. They made a critical stop on fourth down, and they made a critical stop on that 2-point conversion. So that's about 10 plays that were game-changing types of plays that, frankly, we did not see from Oregon last year, hardly at all. I mean, Oregon had pretty much the worst pass rush of Oregon's last, three decades that I can remember last year. They only had 18 sacks all year. They only forced 21 turnovers all year. And if you go back to the teams that have done really, really well for Oregon, they've racked up a ton of sacks and they forced a lot of turnovers. And that doesn't always mean that they keep the team off the scoreboard. It doesn't mean that Oregon's never really had like a brick wall defense, but they have a type of defense that if they score 42, they're probably going to hold you to 28, and they're going to come up with a few of those critical stops, a few game-changing turnovers that help kind of blow the game open. And so I think that was missing last year, and this was a positive sign in that direction. A lot of football left to be played, obviously, as to whether that trend continues. But I think that was an encouragement to me.
Well, It certainly is not going to get any easier after this next weekend. They're playing, of course, Hawaii on Saturday, but then they jump into the Pac-12 slate. Colorado now looms large with primetime, Shedeur Sanders, Dylan Edwards, Travis Hunter. We'll dive into that a little bit later on. If not tonight, then certainly in next week's episode. But let's talk a little bit about the Huskies' win over an outmatched Tulsa team. And, you know, Mark, I noticed something in watching this game against Tulsa that I don't know if this would have ever been the case 3, 4, 5 years ago or longer, but I was really struck by how many players on the Tulsa starting roster were former Power Five, highly recruited players that just didn't work out in wherever they had been before. And so, you know, you had guys that had been recruited and committed to USC, to Oklahoma, to Oklahoma State, and you know, several, you know, notable names. And so it just struck me that although obviously Washington on paper should be the dominant team, it's not quite the same way as it may have been in the old days, where, you know, a kid was just not good enough to get recruited by a D1 school, or not, excuse me, not a D1 school, but a Power Five school. And he ends up settling for Tulsa. Now you've kind of got this shuffling of talent,
yeah,
where, you know, there might be 8 or 9 guys on that team that have the measurables, at least, of being a 5-star or 4-star recruit.
Yeah.
And maybe they just couldn't put it together where they were at before.
Yeah.
It was an interesting insight. Of course, the Huskies did come away with what felt like an unsatisfying 43-10 win over Tulsa. You know, Michael Penix Jr. did what he does, put up big yards. The receivers all, you know, they all had multiple catches for at or around 100 yards. But there were some just terrible drops by some of the receivers that none of us really expected to see, and some penalties. We were just a little bit more sloppy in this game than we were in the Boise State game. So I think it definitely left you know, the team feeling like, hey, we've got some work to do in preparation for Michigan State.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's the purpose of these games, right? Is that they give you a chance to uncover some of those issues to work through without the stakes being so high that you lose a game as a result of it. So you can have, you know, Michael Penix make a poor read on a particular throw, and that's something that then you take back into the lab and you run it through in practice a few more times, and then he's more prepared for that look the next round. So yeah, I think that's after the way that they played against Boise, I think it's reasonable that they had a performance that was just a little less sharp. Because usually at the beginning of the year, teams have that game where they just don't quite have it all together. Washington came out of the gate just so strong,
yeah,
and so emphatic in that Boise win that, you know, I think to me it fits then that the follow-up to that there might be a little more rust that still just kind of needs to be worked through, that seems to be totally reasonable.
Yeah, and Michael Penix did throw an interception, and it's unclear whether or not that was on him. I got the sense that maybe there was a, you know, poor route run by Rome Odunze on that. But Rome had a couple of egregious drops. Jalen McMillan had at the end of the first half had what would have been about a 60-yard touchdown pass that landed directly in his hands, and he just dropped it.
Yeah.
A few plays later, makes a 30-yard reception and fumbles the ball. All of the Husky offensive players watch as the defensive player picks up the ball, begins to run down the field, and only Michael Penix Jr. has the presence of mind to use the sideline to tackle him and get him out of bounds and, you know, allow the clock to run out. But if not for that last drive, because there was, I think there was two drops and the fumble on that drive, Penix probably would have finished with over 500 yards passing and five touchdowns. And so it was just, it was a little bit maddening to watch that, knowing that these are guys that are all American candidates that just kind of let their guard down a little bit in this game. I will say one thing, Mark, though, before we move on, I think there's been a little bit of grumbling from some members of the Husky media and fandom about where the pass rush is right now for the Washington Huskies.
Yeah.
They got a couple sacks on Saturday. They only got one the previous week against Boise State, but they're getting a lot of pressure on the quarterback. And I think that because of Braylon Trice and ZTF and the reputation that they had going into the season, schools are coming in prepared to say, we're going to double and triple team Braylon Trice.
Yep.
And we're going to get rid of the ball really, really quickly.
Yep.
And so, you know, we saw multiple forced three and outs in both games. And I attribute that to the pass rush, even though they didn't get to the quarterback. I think that they are affecting the game. And I would say the other thing is that last year, teams knew that the weakness of the defensive, you know, side of the ball was the backside, the passing game. So they were passing more because that was the weakness to expose, which gave them greater opportunity to get a few more sacks. I think now teams are realizing that the defensive backfield is stronger than it was last year, at least thus far in the season. And they're not passing as much. They're running the ball. They're doing more screen passes. They're trying to get rid of the ball quickly. So I'm not concerned about that in the slightest. If you're a Husky fan listening to this, I wouldn't be concerned about this. When we get into the conference season and there are gunslingers back there who want to get the ball downfield in a hurry, that's going to provide more opportunities to really get after the quarterback. And I think that's really all it is.
Yeah, I think if Braylon Trice is drawing a double or a triple team, and as a result, he's not getting sack numbers, that doesn't mean that he's not having an impact on the game, because that's two or three guys that are occupied with him that are not occupied elsewhere. And you know, sometimes we just look at a stat and we count up something like sacks and make a determination off of that. Oh, well, we're not getting sacks. Well, like you said, if that's leading to quick firing by the quarterback that leads to an incompletion because they don't have time to really get their feet set, or if it leads to them, you know, running a more conservative offense or things like that, that's still an impact just in different ways. So that is the least of my concerns with Washington is the receiving core. The next thing I'm not concerned about is the pass rush.
Yeah.
I think it's definitely going to be fine.
Well, Mark, a long time ago when I was getting my master's degree in Fort Worth, Texas, I had the pleasure of going to a TCU Hawaii game with my dad and got to see an all-time classic battle between running back LaDainian Tomlinson and a very productive young quarterback named Timmy Chang, who was throwing the ball all over the field. It was one of the most entertaining college football games I ever got a chance to attend, with LaDainian Tomlinson running for almost 300 yards in that game. And Timmy Chang, I believe, threw for over 400 yards as well. And now Timmy Chang is Coach Chang for the Hawaii Rainbows. And they're coming to Oregon this weekend. What's your thoughts about this game? Are you concerned at all about the Rainbow Warriors' ability to chuck the ball up and down the field? And what are you looking for as you prepare for this game?
Yeah, I'm not concerned on a win-loss perspective. I mean, Oregon's a 35-point favorite or something like that. So, you know, I'm pretty confident they're going to pull out the win. But I think in terms of Oregon as a defense, where coming into the season, the biggest concern, I think, had to do with the secondary and kind of how they were going to handle some of these outstanding quarterbacks in the Pac-12. And that number is growing. They just played a Texas Tech team that likes to throw the ball around. Now they're going to play a Hawaii team that averages well over 300 passing yards a game. That's going to chuck the ball 40 times a game. And I just look at that as that's really good reps for the defense, as they have Shador Sanders the next week, and they have Michael Penix a couple weeks after that, and they have Caleb Williams a couple weeks after that. That right now you're trying to identify those areas of improvement and make those substantive changes before you get into the heat of your schedule. And I think Hawaii will be the type of team that helps Oregon, both in terms of a secondary and in terms of a pass rush, kind of start to figure some of those things out, or continue to figure some of those things out. So, I'm told basically that I was under the impression that Hawaii is likely to throw a deep ball as much as any team in the country. That, you know, they take shots. And Lanning said that it's the strongest armed quarterback that they've played thus far this season. And so they're expecting, you know, every few plays that Hawaii's just gonna go for the home run ball and see what happens. And it's very possible they complete a couple of those, you know. And so I think that'll be the interesting thing, is like if Oregon comes out of this game and they didn't give up any of those 40 or 50 yard completions, then I would consider that a really good sign for how the secondary was communicating and passing off coverages and doing different things like that. But if they give up two or three of those, then that's certainly a little more of a red flag with the types of teams that Oregon's going to have to face here in the near future.
So if Hawaii finishes with over 300 yards passing, but say less than 80 yards rushing, are you going to be frustrated, or are you going to say, oh, well, that's just how this game was scripted out?
Yeah, I mean, if they dink and dunk their way to 300 yards, that's not really going to unsettle me. I mean, I think I'd be curious to know how many points does that lead to, because if it's...
Right, it may be 12 points or 15.
If it's 14 or 17 points, but they threw for 350 yards, that doesn't really bother me. I think if it's... if they threw for 350 yards and they managed to put together like three scoring drives because of deep passes that they were able to connect on that either scored or got them in really good field position or got them out of their own end, or, you know, some different things like that, like then that's a little more of a concern to me.
Okay. Well, certainly the Huskies have a bit of a more concern this weekend going on the road against a Michigan State team that they faced last year at home. It really was a coming out party for the University of Washington, Kalen DeBoer, Michael Penix Jr. And now the storyline is not going to be Penix or the University of Washington. It's going to be the dismissal or or the suspension of Michigan State head coach Mel Tucker after reports came out of a investigation related to a sexual harassment allegation. So certainly not the news headline that we were expecting going into this game, but Mark, I think one of the things that was interesting to me about this story is who the sexual allegation is coming from. And what I mean by that is that the woman that is, you know, making this allegation, she has made a career of going from college football team to college football team, giving talks and presentations about, you know, honoring women, protecting women, being an advocate for women, because she had been a rape victim in her early 20s. And now she's kind of trying to help educate people. So the way that this story has played out is certainly one of the more bizarre and ironic and unexpected types of stories you could imagine.
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing is pretty troubling. We obviously, I mean, don't know the full story. Mel Tucker is very adamant that he, you know, that whatever happened was consensual, whatever. It just seems really bad. Seems really bad, and does not cast Mel Tucker in a great light. And yeah, when you consider what her role has been and how she even came to be involved with that school and that particular team and the subject matter that she was trying to provide education about, it's just the whole thing is enough to make your stomach turn. It feels like these stories come out of the Big Ten conference disproportionately to everywhere else. It just feels like we get these stories, whether it's, you know, Michigan State gymnastics or Penn State, the Jerry Sandusky stuff, or, I mean, I don't know. We're going in a different direction with the podcast. Right. Just seems like there's
well, some, you know, and getting a little bit back to football, you know, at the end of the 2021 season, Mel Tucker was the belle of the ball. I mean, he had brought Michigan State from the ashes to an unexpected 11-2 season, finished number 9 in the nation, had a victory over Michigan. Kenneth Walker was a Heisman candidate, and he was rewarded with a historic contract. Yeah. 22 rolled around. They started off 2-0. They come to Husky Stadium, get dismantled by the University of Washington, and that was really kind of the beginning of a very disappointing season for Michigan State Spartan football fans. And even though they're 2-0 to start off this season, I think there has been a growing distaste towards what they believe Mel Tucker can bring to this program. So this gigantic contract has been kind of the source of consternation for Michigan State fans when it comes to what do we do if we decide we want to get rid of Mel Tucker. And the only way that they could get rid of Mel Tucker without paying him the $80 million he's owed was if he would be released for reasons of cause, not performance-based. Yeah. And lo and behold, he's being fired, or you know, it looks like after pending an investigation, he's going to be fired for cause. So, you know, you can put on your conspiracy theorist hats and kind of, you know, wax eloquent about whether or not he's being thrown under the bus, whether or not he would have been protected if they were doing better on the field. But however you want to spin it, if you're a Michigan State fan that was thinking, you know what, maybe, you know, Mel Tucker's not our guy, all of a sudden, this whole thing is giving you a little bit of a get out of jail free card to figure out what you're going to do at the end of the season, if not earlier.
Yeah, and Texas A&M fans and administrators have to be looking at this and saying, is there anybody anybody that can come forward with anything on Jimbo Fisher?
what do you got on Jimbo?
So
that's right.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah.
Well, Mark, you know, I don't want to give away something that is you know, that is protected by a paywall, but you know, one thing that has certainly been a storyline going into this game has been the Huskies' record on the road on grass fields, and it's not a good one, and that certainly is a concern, I think, for most Husky fans. Mike Martin from Real Dog wrote a really fascinating article, and I won't share all the details from it, but Michigan State has been preparing their field and preparing their players for this game against the University of Washington. And, you know, just the grass length, the type of, you know, type of cleats that they use, you know, for the game. And so they've really been fine tuning the field for whatever home advantage they can gain. So of course the Huskies have a high flying offense. They're a passing attack. I would assume that going into this game, Michigan State is going to try to slow that down. They're going to try to force the Huskies to run the ball, to dink and dunk, to avoid some of the track meet type of scores that they've been known for over the last couple of years. So to me, that's a pretty significant storyline going into this game.
Yeah, I mean, this goes on a whole different track of the gamesmanship that can go into how a field is prepared. There's stories about, you know, what hockey teams will do to the ice in front of the opposing team's bench that, you know, that affects the skates in a certain way that, you know, I mean, I find it fascinating. I don't think it's necessarily anything dirty or something that when a team lets the grass grow a little longer, knowing which opponent is coming in. I mean, I think you use those things to your advantage if you have a way to do that. And so it's almost enough to make me want to pay to go on Mike Martin's site to read that. But as a Duck fan, I'm not sure that I can bring myself to giving Mike Martin any money for Real Dogs, as much as I love Mike. So that's a very interesting storyline, though. I will be watching the game now with that in mind of kind of trying to figure out is the surface that they're playing on having any sort of impact, or is that helping the Spartans in an identifiable way? I think that's a fascinating angle for this.
Yeah, and you know, I don't think anybody wants to use that as an excuse for any, you know, failure to perform at the highest level. But like you said, it is a factor, and it's. I don't think that they're playing dirty. I don't think that they're doing anything to bend the rules. They're just trying to prepare the field to help their team be as successful as possible. And I would expect any team to do that, especially when they've got a high-powered offense like Washington's coming into town. And speaking of that high-powered offense, you know, we have spoken at great length about the star wide receivers at the University of Washington this year, Rome Odunze, Jalen McMillan, who both had 1,000-yard seasons last year, decided to come back and pursue, you know, the Biletnikoff, pursue helping Penix get a Heisman and pursue a national championship. Jalen Polk, who had, you know, almost 800 yards last year as well. Those three guys are all on pace to finish the season with over 1,000 yards receiving, which is absolutely unbelievable. They all have also run for a touchdown each thus far this season, which is a factor to their game that wasn't really anticipated going into the season. But one more wide receiver seems to be making a name for himself out on the field, and that is the Michigan State transfer, Jeremy Bernard, who will be coming up against his former team. I don't expect that Bernard is going to take over this game or be the central story of this game, but he is our number one kick returner. He's probably the top receiver coming off of the bench after those top three. And he's a guy that has proven that he can get the ball in the backfield as a running back or a running option. So it's going to be fascinating to me to see what ways they utilize Bernard. And will this moment be too big for him? Will this moment, you know, like you mentioned, the young Josh Connerly getting overly excited in the first half on the road. Will this be a moment like that for him? Or could this be his coming out party to the nation as well to say, hey, when Rome and Jalen take off for the NFL at the end of the season, I'm going to be the guy.
Do you think this is an interesting question to me? Do you think you mentioned that those big three receivers have all run for a touchdown?
Yes.
Did I hear that right? So in practice, in the week leading up to a game, I would think the coaching staff, you know, Kalen DeBoer and Ryan Grubb are thinking in terms of like, oh, this, you know, we've got this particular play we'd like to run in this situation. We think, you know, we could use that. And whether they have one of those specific receivers in mind or whether it's just kind of who happens to be out on the field when the play is called, you know, I have a feeling that there's some thought put into at least the play call and the situation, and they're going in kind of knowing that thing is in their back pocket and when they want to call it. So I'm wondering if they have a play like that in mind for the Michigan State game, do they go out of their way to call it for Jeremy Bernard? Or is it just one of those things that I tend to think that coaches are so hyper-focused on just winning the game that they're not nearly as tuned into some of these storylines as we think they are, you know, that if Jeremy Bernard ends up scoring a touchdown, that we'll probably equate it to like, oh, well, Kalen DeBoer wanted him to get a touchdown against his former team. But in reality, it would probably just be a situational thing if he happened to be in the right place at the right time. But there's also kind of the storyteller in me that would like to think that there's some sort of effort to set him up for some success in this game.
No, I mean, without a doubt. And I think, you know, you're spot on in a couple senses. I think in the one sense, I think that the, when they have the opportunity to do something like that, coaches love to do it. You know, and we saw an example of that in this past game against Tulsa. You know, you were mentioning how Oregon likes to go for two early in the game. Well, the Huskies had a 2-point conversion trick play in which the long snapper for the team snapped the ball and then ran out and caught a pass from Dylan Morris for 2 points. And I think that was 100% just them saying, hey, you know, you work your tail off, you're a team player, you don't get a lot of recognition, here you go. And it's Tulsa, we feel pretty good about, you know, this isn't going to cost us the game if it doesn't work out. Yeah. So I think they did it there. Against Michigan State on the road, I don't think they're going to go out of their way to, you know, help somebody get a special touchdown for sentimentality or, you know, to make a statement to their former team or anything like that. But I do think that one of the unique things for both of these squads, and maybe you can kind of let some light on this with the journey that, you know, Marcus Mariota went through as the Heisman Trophy winner. But when a player like Penix comes into the season as a Heisman candidate, I would think that from a coaching staff perspective, you are saying, okay, we've got to make sure that we're doing what we can do to help, you know, bolster that argument, that reputation. So does that mean, you know, if Michigan State brings a defense in which they're dropping eight into coverage on every single down, you know, do the Huskies say, hey, we have to run it, and Penix ends up throwing for 240 yards, a touchdown, and they win the game by, you know, 14 points? Or do they say, like, nope, you know, we're going to dance with the one who brought us here, and Michael Penix is our guy, and he can beat any defense. We can out-scheme it. You know, like, what do you think some of the thinking is when it comes to that? Because, you know, obviously priority number one is win the game, but they are trying to help build his resume, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I think especially with a quarterback who's handling the ball on every play, I think the thought process in a coaching staff's mind is what's best for the offense as a whole is what's best for the quarterback. And so if you remember those Mariota teams, I mean, he ended up throwing, I think he threw 42 touchdown passes that year. Mm-hmm. But Oregon was always a dominant run first team, you know, and
running was a part of his game too.
And running was a part of his game. You know, he ran for over 700 yards that year. So, but I mean, they definitely had games during that season where they just rode Royce Freeman and Thomas Tyner. And those guys had huge games rushing the ball. And then Mariota would finish like 19 of 23. For 220 yards, three touchdowns, or something like that, like a hyper efficient, but not necessarily like jaw dropping in terms of the total amount of yardage. But I don't think that goes into a coach's mind in terms of like, oh, he's only at 200 yards, and we need to try to get him up to 300 by the end of the game. I don't think they're thinking in those terms. I think coaches are always thinking about the next possession and how do we take the legs out from underneath the opponent, and you know, what's the best strategy for that? And I think if that means it's running the same running play 12 times in a row, then you do that. And if it means we're going to throw the ball 40 or 50 times a game, then you do that. And so I think the best thing for Penix would be for the Washington coaching staff to just focus on trying to score every drive, and the rest will take care of itself, especially with that group of receivers. I mean, they're so talented, and I have a hard time seeing Washington change their identity to where we're just seeing Washington just kind of ground and pound, especially when you lost your first string running back to a season-ending injury before the season even started. I just think that this is a team that's going to be pass first all season long, I assume.
No, that's good insight. Well, hey, let's wrap it up. It's been another great episode. Thank you, everybody, for listening to the show. Mark, any final thoughts or predictions heading into this weekend?
I think Washington will have a closer game than Oregon. That's my prediction.
Okay. Not entirely a risky call, but
no, I think, yeah. I think Washington will win. And what are they, a 16 point favorite? I think they will cover.
Yeah.
I'm well aware, Warren, that playing against an interim coach is not necessarily something that the Huskies thrive under those circumstances. And so you've got Michigan State shaking up the coaching staff. Sometimes a team will get a little bit of a bounce from that. But I think this situation is different. I think shaking up a coaching staff of a losing team by getting rid of the losing coach, having an assistant take over and change the culture, that can jumpstart a losing team. Michigan State was 2-0 to start the year and was feeling fairly optimistic, and now their coach is out the door. And I don't see that being a positive for the culture of the program and in this week as they try to prepare for a really good Washington team.
No, I agree. We don't always do score predictions, but I am going to predict the Huskies win. I'm going to say 45-24 is the final score for the Huskies. So convincing win. Last year we won 39-28 and we kind of let them score some late touchdowns to make it seem closer than it actually was. But I think this is a game that the Huskies are going to, they're going to try to keep the foot on the gas the whole way through. And especially knowing that they're going to be entering into the Big Ten Conference. And I think they want to show themselves well to all the potential recruits in that part of the country that are making decisions about what kind of team they want to be a part of. So, all right. Well, with that, we'll wrap it up. Thank you, all of our dog fans, for listening. And as we always do, we'll wrap up for our dog fans with Go Dogs.
And for all our duck fans, Go Ducks.
All right, guys, we'll catch you next time.